Well, thank you very much, Bill, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen. You know, I thought I was going to be coming up here after a good bit of humor from Joe Morris and just kind of fill in and end the session. But, Bill, I'm glad you brought in a little theatrical history there and a good quote. But here we are in New Orleans, enjoying the sunshine while watching it from the inside. You know, it's interesting when you think of Louisiana, one doesn't necessarily put that together with the rule of law. And when we think of New Orleans, such things as Mardi Gras, Huey Long, and jazz come to mind. Now, the first two, I think, seem quite clearly to be against the stability that's required by the rule of law. Mardi Gras is the turning of the world upside down, or at least so it seems the morning after. And Huey Long is only useful in that he shows what happens when the rule of law is flouted and tyranny reigns. But what about jazz? Well, on the surface, the link between jazz and the rule of law might be somewhat distant. But the emphasis on improvisation, for example, which jazz includes in as an integral part of its music, might be thought to be the musical analogy to former Justice Brennan's idea of a living constitution. That is that which deconstructs the past. But here at the Philadelphia Society, we're entitled to go beneath the surface and look a little more deeply into these things. First of all, there's that famous quote from Ken Burns, the documentary filmmaker, which he said, "When they study our American civilization 2,000 years from now, we'll only be known for three things: the Constitution, baseball, and jazz music." Well, let's look at the idea then of improvisation. I would suggest to you that it is, in many ways, in music as it is in life, it's not just something that is made up without some limitations, without some rules. It's founded upon solid arrangements, or as they call them, establishments. Indeed, before Louis Armstrong became a virtuoso soloist, he was trained and nurtured in the 1920s New Orleans ensemble playing, where invisible rules guided the musical artists. In summary, good improvisation in jazz is like an amendment process. Changes and improvements can take place, but they have to be consistent with the orderly establishment of the arrangements. So even in music, as in all aspects of a society in which people must get along together, rules or norms are essential to basic living, let alone to good music or progress. Well, many of you know by now that New Orleans and Louisiana are unique in many different ways. This includes, of course, their legal system. If you look for legal software or get it on the internet, either to write wills or other common tasks, there's a warning on the label that always reads, "Not applicable to the state of Louisiana." Is this true also of the rule of law? No, I would suggest, despite the uniqueness of Louisiana, because that uniqueness in the law, at least, is due to the fact that Louisiana follows not the common law of England that we heard so much about already this morning, but rather the civil code derived from its French origins. But nevertheless, the rule of law still pertains. To give one example that I hope is not too arcane to us lawyers, the Louisiana has its own counterpart to the doctrine in common law of stare decisis. Stare decisis means that precedents follow each other and lawyers follow the precedents of the past. Cases have been decided. It's Latin, stare decisis, that the decision stands. They have in Louisiana the doctrine of jurisprudence constant. That is a doctrine that doesn't contemplate that you follow every individual case as precedent for future cases, but rather when a principle is repeated by a long line of decisions, then a rule of law has been accepted and applied by the courts, and then it assumes this dignity of jurisprudence constant and is followed subsequently and is then entitled to great weight in subsequent decisions where that principle is applicable. Well, why is the rule as important in Louisiana as it is elsewhere? Let me quote a Louisiana case which summarizes our weekend very well. It says, fundamental and elementary principles recognize that certainty and constancy of the law, which are indispensable to orderly social discourse, a sound economic climate, and a stable government. Well, in many ways, that's what the Philadelphia Society has stood for and stands for today, since its founding by Don Lipset in 1964. Orderly social discourse, precisely what we do at our meetings, made more lively in some meetings than others. Certainly made lively today by Lino Graglia. Sound economic climate, precisely why we support liberty and free markets. Stable government, again, precisely why we support the Constitution and the rule of law. And so this noon, I'd like to look at the rule of law and examine briefly three issues that I believe pose current challenges to that rule. I realize that discussing contemporary matters at a meeting of the Philadelphia Society poses some risks to the speaker, and I do so at my own peril, but I want to assure you that the issues I'm going to discuss this noon are directly related to concerns that were perceived and to their thinking solved by the founders more than two centuries ago. The first has to do with the limitations, or the lack thereof, on judicial power. Ken Starr, at this same lectern last night, raised this topic when he discussed the legitimate extent of judicial power, ranging from Lord Coke's proclamation of the supremacy of judicial authority to Alexander's reference in the Federalist Papers to the judiciary as the least dangerous branch of government. I must say this about Alexander Hamilton. He was probably a great Secretary of the Treasury. He was undoubtedly a great warrior, a great soldier in the War for Independence, but he was sure a lousy prophet. The purpose of the United States Constitution, among other things, of course, was to control the exercise of governmental power to preserve the liberties of the people, to implement the concept that public officials ruled with the consent of the governed. Under that concept, the Constitution should be as much a limitation on judicial power as it is on the power of the executive and the legislative branches. The founders viewed judging as very different from either the responsibilities of the executive or the legislative body. Judging in their mind, and you see this in the Federalist Papers, had to do with interpreting law, not making or implementing it. Indeed, Madison proclaimed that combining the executive, legislative, and judicial functions in the same hands, as he said, of one or of many, is the very definition of tyranny. Well, today we call this usurpation by the courts of executive and legislative power judicial activism. It occurs when judges step outside of their interpretive role and substitute their personal policy preferences in place of what the Constitution provides or what a statute enacted by the people's legislative representatives actually says. Two political scientists, Ken Stepsel and Mark Bonchek, in their book on analyzing politics, puts this very well when they refer to such judges as, quote, legislators in robes, unquote. The decisions of these judges are fashioned to achieve preconceived results rather than to be consistent and to apply the applicable law. As Robert Bork has written in his book, The Tempting of America, which is probably one of the best discussions of the role of judges, and by contrast, the abuses of that role, he said, the habit of legislating policy from the bench, once acquired, is addictive, and hence by no means confined to constitutional cases. The activist or revisionist judge, he said, can no more restrain himself from doing what he sees as, quote, good, unquote, in construing a statute than when he purports to speak with the voice of the Constitution. When judges act in such a manner, as Alexander Bickel has stated, then their authority over us is totally intolerable and totally irreconcilable with the theory and practice of political democracy. Judicial activism is frequently accompanied, or in some cases caused, by what we might call judicial arrogance. Thomas Sowell talks about judicial hubris, the conceit that anyone can make the sort of judgments needed to direct in exquisite detail the fortunes of innumerable fellow citizens engaged in extraordinarily complex interactions that depend on a web of constantly changing facts and values. Tom Sowell goes on to compare judicial activists to the central planners of failed socialism and contrasts such top-down social control decision-making to add as the much more successful decentralized decision-making that's informed by hundreds or thousands of people in an enormous network of social, economic, and political relationships making their own individual decisions. As Ronald Cass describes in his book, The Rule of Law in America, the height of judicial arrogance is illustrated by the reaction of one judge of, where else, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, in which the Supreme Court reviewed 29 decisions from the circuit, reversing 28. When asked about it, that judge was not at all upset by this because, as he said, in effect, they can't catch all my decisions. I'll leave it to you to guess who that judge might be. But activist judges don't usurp only legislative functions. Courts have imposed their will on numerous executive entities and tried to carry out executive functions through special masters and various other contrivances. And as a result, they have been running schools, prisons, local governments, mental institutions, universities, and the like. Since they have little experience and even less expertise in running these organizations, they frequently fail to even achieve the desired social results and often impose supposed remedies that are not only ineffective, but are exorbitantly costly, both in terms of funds, the taxpayers' funds, and also in the loss of freedom. Ken Starr actually brought up last night a startling comparison of how the Supreme Court has handled two different cases and the contrast of the results from the way in which each was handled. He talked about the abortion and the physician-assisted suicide cases. Both deal with the same subject, if you will, life and death, but at opposite ends of the human continuum. In Roe against Wade, the Supreme Court invented a supposedly constitutional right, which was made up out of whole cloth. And it's interesting to look back because some 30 years later, people have forgotten how at the time, virtually every legal commentator indicated that there was no real basis in the law or in the Constitution. And there was very little support among legal scholars for that decision. What they did in the course of that decision, they arrogated the subject of abortion to federal control. And no matter how you may feel about the subject one way or the other, it was taken out of the hands of the state governments where common matters such as this, things like family law, parental rights, matters pertaining to children, and so on, had always been handled. Secondly, they took a controversial moral issue away from the legislative process and thus excluded the people's representatives from determining a complex matter of social conscience. The result, of course, has been three decades of protest, of public disputes, and recurring cases returning to the Supreme Court. Because once a court starts legislating, it's hard to stop. By contrast, when the case that had to do with physician-assisted suicide came up, they looked at the Constitution, and they rightly found that there was nothing in the Constitution that pertained to that topic. And as a result, they left it to the states and, of course, to the people through their legislative representatives. Thus, Oregon does it one way. Other states do it other ways. But we haven't had the ongoing controversy because the people had it still within their power through their representatives to determine how this moral issue would be handled. As the Wall Street Journal said yesterday, in a different context, but referring to this controversy that I've mentioned and the contrasting way in which these cases were handled, had abortion been left to legislatures at the state level in the 1970s, we would long ago have settled the issue with a democratic compromise and spared our politics 30 years of cultural rancor and polarization. Well, this problem of judicial activism raises important questions of constitutional government and citizen liberty. But it also leads to the second challenge I'd like to talk about today, and that is the politicization of the judicial system. This is demonstrated in the battle that's going on now in the United States Senate over the confirmation of Miguel Estrada, Priscilla Owen, and how many more judicial nominees we don't know. Now, of course, I recognize that these remarks may be overcome by events in the event that President Bush takes up Randy Barnett's suggestion and threatens the recess appointment of Lino Gallia, to the Supreme Court. But until he does that, let's look at the situation. President Bush is seeking to appoint federal judges who are faithful to the Constitution, who understand the limitations on the role of judges, and who believe in judicial restraint rather than judicial activism. By contrast, the liberals in the Senate want judicial activists on the bench. Liberal senators take this position because they are beholden to a number of extremist organizations, so-called People for the American Way, the organization that calls itself the Alliance for Justice. And these are organizations that represent coalitions of leftist activists who seek to achieve policy goals through the courts because they cannot get them enacted by either Congress or state legislatures, since these institutions and represent the people, the majority of whom reject the leftist notions that these organizations would like to push. And so the Senate liberals are trying three strategies. The first is to filibuster and impose a 60-vote requirement for the future confirmation of judges. Now, obviously, with Miguel Estrada and Priscilla Owen and the others that have been held up, some of them for 2 years now, this is only a warm-up. I suspect the real target of these activist organizations is the first vacancy that may occur on the United States Supreme Court. And so they're trying to establish this idea that if they can make the filibuster stand with these cases, they can do the same thing. And of course, their hope then is to coerce a president into appointing someone more to their liking. Secondly, they're engaging in character assassination and accusations, false accusations of extremism, to prevent constitutionally faithful judges from being confirmed. And third, they are trying to intimidate future judges themselves by extorting pledges in advance on how they would vote on particular issues. Again, referring to Dean Cass's book, The Rule of Law in America, he says, politicians ask potential judges questions about the weight they would give to precedent or text, but the questions frequently are attempts to get a promise or a confession. Senators want the nominee to take a stand publicly on those issues that are likely to come before them on the bench, such as abortion. Well, the combination of these strategies on the left corrupt the confirmation process and thus threaten the integrity and the independence of the judiciary. A third problem I'd like to discuss with you also challenges the rule of law, and that's the overcriminalization of social and economic conduct. Congress has developed a nasty habit of adding criminal penalties to regulatory legislation, not because the conduct that is being regulated or prohibited is evil or antisocial, but to show that they really consider the matter important. This is particularly true in the environmental and the economic regulatory areas. People can and do go to prison for nothing more than making some innocent mistakes in paperwork. They even are convicted of crimes for the mistakes of others who fall under their supervision, despite the fact that they had no part in the prohibited conduct and did not even know that it had occurred. Such ideas of strict liability are foreign to the basic principles of criminal law, but today are too common as a part of congressional and sometimes state legislation. To show how wrong this new view of criminalization is and how it threatens individual liberty, you have to go back to the basics. The origin of modern criminal law can be traced back to early feudal times, as we heard this morning. From its inception, the criminal law expressed both a moral and a practical judgment about the social consequences of certain activity. To be a crime, the law required that an individual must both cause, through an or attempt to cause, a wrongful injury, but also he must do it with some form of malicious intent. In order to be a crime, then, there has to be both a bad act and a guilty mind. At its roots, the criminal law did not punish merely bad acts, intentions to act without any evil deed. The criminal law did not punish bad thoughts, that is, an intention to act without any actual evil deed, or acts that achieved unwittingly wrongful ends without the intent to do so. The evil thoughts were deemed to be a matter for ecclesiastical authorities to deal with, and the unintended acts were a matter for tort law to handle. So the law historically then has required that before an individual is declared to be a criminal, he must have acted with an intent and have done wrong. Accidents and mistakes are not considered crimes. Yet contemporary criminal law too often punishes acts of negligence and even acts which are accidental. In the regulatory context, as Justice Potter Stewart once opined, there is, in effect, a standard of near absolute liability. Well, to these fundamental changes in the nature of criminal liability, one must also add that there's been a significant change in the subject matter of criminal legislation. At its inception, the criminal law was directed at conduct that society virtually universally recognized as inherently wrongful and, in some sense, immoral. These acts were wrong in and of themselves, things like murder, rape, robbery, burglary, and the like. They were malum in se, as the lawyers like to quote. You remember, if all else fails, quote a little Latin, that'll impress your clients. Well, in recent times, the reach of the criminal law has been expanded so that it now addresses conduct that is wrongful not because of any intrinsic nature, but because a legislature someplace has declared it to be wrong. It's a wrong created by a legislative body to satisfy some perceived public good. Thus, essentially regulatory crimes have become to be known as public welfare offenses. Today, then, the criminal law has strayed far from its historical roots. Many statutes punish those whose acts are wrongful only by virtue of legislative determination, often at the behest of some special interest group. The consequences of this are twofold: a pathological legislative approach to criminal law and an excess of prosecutorial discretion. Now, it may seem strange for a person who served as the Attorney General and was once a prosecutor to complain about prosecutorial discretion, but where the prosecutorial discretion is so broad that almost anyone can be put in jail, and when, as some scholars have opined, first they seek the target and then they find the crime, that's the wrong way for a prosecutor to be able to go about his business. The legislative impetus is clear. There's many times a market of public approval, at least among certain special interest groups, for more criminal laws and for no effective consideration of countervailing costs to society. And in the absence of any judicial check on this legislative trend, and the courts hesitate to get into this field, leaving it to the legislature, then the result is a wholesale transfer of power from elected legislative officials to prosecutors who in many instances are unelected and not responsible to the public. Well, where once, in order to be a criminal, an individual had to do an act or attempt to do it with willful intent to violate the law and with knowledge of the wrongful nature of his conduct, today it is possible to be found criminally liable, branded as a criminal, and imprisoned for a substantial term of years for the failure to do an act required by law without any knowledge or any actual knowledge of the law's obligation and with no wrongful intent whatsoever. It is ultimately, then, the triumph of a Benthamite utilitarian concept of the criminal law over the morally grounded understanding of criminal law that's written about by William Blackstone. As Paul Rosenzweig, who's at Heritage, is our senior legal research fellow, in a very interesting paper he wrote on this subject, recently said, given how the criminal law has developed, a free people are constrained to ask the question, are broader social needs well served when individual liberty and individual responsibility suffer? Well, here then are three current challenges to the rule of law. One would deny the people access to the formulation of laws that affect their most cherished values and substitute the tyranny of activist judges. The second challenge would deny us judges who are faithful to the Constitution and who understand the limitations on their power. And thirdly, there's the perversion of the criminal law to fulfill ideological aspirations, which empowers officious governmental enforcers to violate the freedom of our citizens. Together, they contribute to the erosion of the rule of law, which our speakers discussed this morning. We often talk about the rule of law in terms such as those expressed by John Adams in the 1780 Constitution of Massachusetts, namely that we have a government of laws and not of men. This concept stands for the principle that even governments must obey the law and cannot exercise their considerable power in an arbitrary and capricious manner. Dean Cass describes this concept as having four constituent elements: fidelity to rules, including the Constitution, of principled predictability, so people know what's right and what's wrong, embodied in valid authority, that is, the authority that comes from the consent of the governed through their elected representatives in making the law, and that is external to individual government decision makers, so that all people, including those making decisions, fall under the law. Well, to combat the erosion and to restore these fundamental principles of the rule of law, we as a nation must meet the challenges that I've described here. They take our legal and our judicial system on a quite different course from that that was charted by the founders of our nation. Only by returning to the constitutional principles that were designed to give us a government of laws and not of men can we restore in our country, and as an example to the rest of the world, the primacy of the rule of law, and thereby protect the freedom of our people. Thank you.